For today's class, we want to start with Acts chapter 4, verses 21 and 22. We're still in the context of Peter, John. They've been brought before the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin had that conference. We talked about the fact that that word that's used there, I think it's back in verse 15, they were throwing around ideas. They conferred among themselves. That word translated conferred in Acts 4:15, tossing around a lot of ideas because they really don't have any good options. Then beginning in verse 21, and they, when they had further threatened them, let them go, finding nothing how they might punish them, because of the people. Let's see, my page was kind of creased there. Let's try that again. And they, when they had further threatened them, let them go, finding nothing how they might punish them, because of the people, for all men glorified God for that which was done. For the man that was more than 40 years old, on whom this miracle of healing was wrought. Now, Luke, remember who he was as far as his profession? He was a doctor. When you go to the doctor, they're always interested in the vital signs, right? You know, what's your blood pressure, what's your cholesterol, and let's check out your height, let's look at your weight. So it's not surprising as Luke writes this book that he pays attention to this fact. And you also have him, not only the author of this book, but the book of Luke, he paid attention to the man's condition back in Acts chapter 3, verse 2. The fellow had been unable to walk since when? Since birth. That also would have been of great interest to Luke. And this was, for him, surely a fantastic medical miracle. We've mentioned before that when you think about physical defects, people sometimes will go through various surgeries to try to correct them, and that's not what we have happening here. This is something that was healed instantly, it was healed fully, and it truly was amazing. Because the miracle was so stupendous, how much was there as far as what the Sanhedrin could say against the apostles? Nothing. The miracle couldn't be disputed, and as you look at what Peter and John had done, they were involved with no wrong. They had not committed any kind of crime. There was no sin that they had been involved with. They were simply preaching the gospel of Christ. Then, in addition to that, as the people of Jerusalem are described, what word is used? See it in verse 21? Because of the people, for how many men? All men. Now, do you think that's literally true in the city of Jerusalem, every single person is being described? No. I don't think that has to be understood literally, but it means that there was a high percentage, a great number. And what were they doing? They were praising God, glorifying God, and here again is a place where you might want to stop and ask the question, what tense is used? If you had to make a guess, what would you think? It's that ongoing tense. This was something that was continuously being done. And that certainly created a great problem for the Sanhedrin. Now, that lines up pretty well with a couple of passages that we're familiar with, at least one. Remember Mark chapter 16, verse 20? Mark 16, Jesus gives the Great Commission, go preach the gospel. And what did they do? They what the word with the signs that followed. They confirmed the word. Remember that? Mark 16, verse 20? That's what we have here. They were confirming the word, and they did confirm the word by this great sign. You have a similar point in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 4. Now, if you're the Sanhedrin, everybody's glorifying God, or there's a high percentage of people. The apostles have done nothing wrong. They're upsetting your apple cart. I mean, they're headed in a direction that's the very opposite of where you're headed spiritually. And they're really a threat to your power. What are you thinking as far as your options are? Or you can reverse the question and say, what would we not want to do? You're one of those judges. What's going through your mind?
Well, you don't want to advertise it any more than you have to already.
All right.
I mean, it's already big, so you certainly don't want to
do. You don't want to throw fuel on the fire. Yes. Yes. And I think that sums it up very, very well. You have to be very careful. You don't want to give the impression that you're condoning it, do you? Because that's going to be bad. You really don't want to do that. But all the people are glorifying God. So if you really clamp down hard on these folks, that's probably not going to go over. There might be some kind of rebellion. You might have a mob action. And that's definitely not going to be good. So when you look at all the things that are taking place, logically, I think you're forced to just one place. One action, and what's that? You probably don't want to keep him in jail. You don't want to kill him like you did Jesus. And you can't just let him go. So what do you do? All right, and isn't that the way it works today? You have somebody that's creating a problem for you. Now, hopefully this isn't how it works with Christians, but you have somebody who's creating a problem for you, and you can't condone it. You can't just let it go. You can't go out and knock them off, but you can go out and try to intimidate them. You can go out and make threats, and that's exactly what we find here. In verse 21, that word which is translated threatened is not found anywhere else in the New Testament, and it means to add threats to threaten further. Now, that threat's pretty significant because as you look at the next chapter, Acts chapter 5, I believe it's verse 28. High priest asked them, that's the end of verse 27, saying, we did what? We...
Are you saying verse 27?
Well, at the end of 27 in Acts chapter 5, the high priest asked them, and then in 28, what did he say? We strictly charged you, we strictly commanded you not to teach. So this threat was not forgotten about the Sanhedrin when you get over into the next chapter. They remembered it. And they wanted that threat to be something that the apostles remembered. When you look at these fellows, you can, I think, understand why the Sanhedrin did what it did. Are there some people in life, when they give a command, they're accustomed to having it obeyed? Not questioned? Yeah, there'd be some people. Who would fall into that category? All right, I think that's probably one of the better examples. It's the general, the colonel, whoever that is. Maybe it's a non-commissioned officer who has some rank. He gives that order, and he expects it to be obeyed. Don't question it. Who else?
Dictators.
All right, you think about, you know.
North Korea, something like that.
Yeah, North Korea, Castro. You say this, and, you know, people don't ask how high to jump. I mean, they just jump, and if they need to jump again, they will. When you look at the Sanhedrin, do you think that they were accustomed to living in that way? I mean, when we give an order, you carry it out. You don't backtalk us. You don't ask twice about it. You just do what we say do. And when you have these fellows, Peter and John, coming before these guys, they respect their authority, but they're not willing to do what they want. It seems like they needed this extra authoritative command to be very, very emphatic. Now, the apostles probably knew that they were going to get into some trouble. I mean, the Sanhedrin obviously had a great deal of power. They knew that Rome had given the Jews a great deal of latitude as far as authority. So they knew that they were in hot water, but still they handled it very, very well. A couple of practical lessons, and then we'll see if there's anything that you want to address. Today, when we look at cases where a person says, I don't believe in God, I don't believe what you're teaching, and so forth, oftentimes do they put that rejection, their rejection, on someone or something else? You know, they will blame someone, something else. You know, I know how you live, or there's this, or I was mistreated by someone, or whatever it might be. Isn't that what we see with the Sanhedrin? They're trying to put the blame on the apostles. You know, you guys are the ones who are the rabble-rousers. You are the fellows who are stirring up the problems here in Jerusalem. And the second practical lesson, which I find a great deal of comfort in. Eventually, and it takes a little while, what happens to the Sanhedrin? Where are they today? They're gone. Now, exactly when they faded from history, I don't know. But here were some people who were opposed to God, opposed to the gospel, and as time marched on, eventually, they just go by the wayside.
But don't we still have people that have a lot of the same beliefs, same ideas, some of them not called Sanhedrins, but that belief that they have, a lot of them are still here.
Yeah, it is. So when you look at what we have here and you compare that to modern society, things have not changed that much. Very good. Anybody else? Bonnie?
Is there, you know, the structure that we have here in the United States, I could understand Jews here not having a Sanhedrin, but is it the same way over there in Israel? And
I'm not aware of their court system.
What their system is over there, that yeah. They have some form of that? I don't know.
Well, when you look at the decisions which come out of Israel, you never hear about a Sanhedrin.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Netanyahu, and you've got the cabinet and so forth, but nothing like the Sanhedrin. So like I say, at some point the wheels came off of that organization, and the power that these guys had and surely wanted to hold on to, it just dissipated with time, and they finally lost it. But evil people, the dictators, as Don mentioned, sometimes they're in power for a while, and then maybe democracy or a different form of government arises. So People think that they can cling to that power and hold on to it for years and years, and eventually it has to be put down.
Well, this is a question about the Sanhedrin. They were a powerful group. I'm a little bit confused about why they were scared of the people. It seems like people should have been afraid of them, and yet just seems like for some reason or other, they just backed away from them, and almost as if they thought that people would actually do them some harm. I think of it in terms of our Supreme Court. It seems like no matter what happens, people stay away from the Supreme Court. And I think it's because of their power. And it seems to me like the Sanhedrin had the same type of a situation, and yet they backed away from the people in this case. And the people actually hadn't threatened them. It's just that they were afraid to do anything that the people might rise up against them. And that seems kind of strange to me.
Two quick points there. I'm going to take my first one and sort of relate it to what Bonnie said. I remember Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD. I think that probably, that may not have completely dismantled the Sanhedrin, but once Rome comes in and sacks, and you know, sacks the city and knocks everything down, that had to have a significant impact on them. And that could have been the time where things just sort of fall apart and they never recover from that. Now, to Stan's point, people sometimes are very, very interesting. And one of the things, you don't see this too often, but one example of it would be preppers. Anybody hear about some of the preppers right now as far as some of the CEOs of big companies? I read an article about this a couple of days ago. This is very, very fascinating stuff.
What are preppers?
Preppers. Well, you're thinking apocalyptic times. You know, for example, if you don't like Trump, there are some people who think that the world's going to end, everything's going to have a big meltdown, stock market's going to crash, and we're going to have a problem getting food and medicine, and housing, people are going to be breaking in your houses, and, you know, it's just going to be absolute chaos. So you are a prepper. You'll store guns and ammunition and, you know, knives and food and medical supplies and all those things. There are some people right now, and I'm not saying that he's one of them, but Bill Gates, to give you an example of a CEO who's way up there at the top, or you would look at Zuckerberg. Again, I don't know if he would fall into that category, but people of large corporations like that, they are going, at least some of them, they're going to great lengths right now because they think, you know, they're thinking in apocalyptic terms that things are going to get real bad. And I guess New Zealand is the place where a lot of people who have a lot of money are going. And it's sort of the wink and the nod. Hey, you got your place in New Zealand? You know, wink, wink. And that's the indication that I'm a prepper. Are you a prepper? Well, it may not be to that same degree, but when you find people who are in power like that, you have that. When you look at dictators, taking that in a slightly different direction, you know, you think about Saddam Hussein, where'd they find him? You know, he's hiding out in that spider hole and so forth. So there does seem to be with some people who have a lot of power, at least in certain cases, paranoia. Now, whether or not that was true for the Sanhedrin, maybe they thought that there'd be a real rebellion and that that would cause Rome to get involved. I don't know. But it's interesting to me that you do find people who have achieved a measure of success or power sometimes that they get really worried about losing their power. And maybe it goes back a little bit to what Jesus described in Matthew chapter 6. You know, he talked about the treasures on earth. You know, people will try to store up treasures. They'll try to, layer security and so forth, and we'll get vaults and we'll get security people and alarms and all those things because they feel so insecure. And power, I think, sometimes creates that in the minds of people. Not everybody, but some. And that may be what we have here. Carol or Don? Oh, okay, you're just going to keep that thought internal. Okay, that's fine. Virginia?
It was on the news this week. I didn't pay too much attention to it. There's a calendar somewhere. And it's getting close to the end of time.
The
apocalyptic.
The doomsday calendar.
Yeah.
Okay.
Huh. But if you look a little farther, in 1992, it was set back to 17 minutes, to 15 or 17 minutes.
Huh.
And I looked to see what was going on. Well, that was Bush was president, and that he was about as popular as, well, not maybe not quite as popular as Trump, but I thought, well, that's very accurate.
Yeah. Well, you have all kinds of interesting ideas out there, but there are some preppers, and there have always been, especially in our area. If you have a chance to go out and start talking to some people here, you will find that in our part of the country, and they're probably scattered all over, but in our part of the country, we do definitely have some preppers. I mean, that's just a fact.
I bowl with a lady that's one.
All right. Well, like I say, you know, you start learning a few more things about some people, and they may or may not be very religious, but it's interesting as far as some of the ideas that you'll encounter. All right, did that exhaust our hands?
I work with a lady. They didn't have the underground,
system
that where they would go and hide. But she did. She would stockpile food and constantly rotate it. Mm-hmm. She had at least a year's supply of food stockpiled and would constantly rotate through that because she said, "I never know. You never know when you might not have food, you know."
Well, we do know how people act. When a storm moves in, they're talking about a hurricane or they're talking about some other big natural. People go to the stores and, I mean, they just clean it all out. And, you know, what do stores keep? 2 or 3 days of food in there as far as what's normal on the shelves? Something like that. It's not a lot. And that can create, at least in the short term, a problem. I've heard, I don't have any way to prove it or any way to try to figure out whether or not it's really accurate, but supposedly tunnels have been built. You've got bunkers in the area of Washington, D.C., and that, again, I think goes back to what we were talking about. You know, we've got to protect ourselves at all costs when the end comes, or if there's some major fallout, politicians have a place to go, and we can preserve ourselves and our families. So it's interesting what men will do.
Now, they've shown some of those tunnels, the programs on some of that, where if a certain thing happens, they quickly take the senators and the House of Representatives and the Vice President and all, they'll take them to different areas. They don't want them all in one place.
Right.
But they'll take them to different areas. And something I guess I've never really thought of, but it makes sense. Do you know that the Vice President and the President never fly together?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's just, I guess in a way that's preparation in case anything happens.
Well, politicians seem like Sanhedrin not being an exception. Politicians always seem like they've been very good, very adept at covering their backside. Mm-hmm. You know, they want a way out. They want some kind of job security. So I can get over to this country if everything falls apart, or I've got money in this account over here in the Cayman Islands, whatever it might be. And the Sanhedrin, they're doing the same thing. They're thinking, well, okay, we've got to deal with it, but can't do this because of the people. So it's the same old stuff.
Not as severe as this, but my mom and dad both lived through the Depression, and they had a system of stocking up food because they lived through it.
Yeah, and there's no problem.
Depression, you know, could be something as simple. Well, I'm not saying that's simple, but not, you know, something on a. It could happen.
Yeah.
In various ways.
Sure, and there's no problem. Nothing wrong with stocking up some things, but when you look at some of the CEOs that I was talking about, I mean, they're stocking up, for example, on ammunition. They were talking about tens of thousands of rounds.
Yeah, I know.
And, you know, and the food supply, you know, they didn't give any specific examples, but, you know, you're talking about 10, 20, 30 years of food. But, again, you can see very secular thinking there as far as a mindset. So it's kind of crazy. All right, back to Acts 4. Let's look at verses 23 and 24. And being let go, they came to their own company and reported all that the chief priests and the elders had said unto them. And they, when they heard it, lifted up their voice to God with one accord and said, O Lord, thou that didst make the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that in them is. The Sanhedrin, as we mentioned, they didn't have any basis to charge the apostles with anything. There was not a scrap of evidence as far as wrongdoing on the part of these fellows. So they're released. And as these men are released, where do they go? Luke said they go back to their own. You said companions? Okay, companions is one word. All right, fellow believers. Now, there's a question there. Did they go back to the other apostles, or did they go back to not apostles, Christians, or maybe they went back to both? can't tell for sure. Some people believe that they went back to the other apostles and made a report to them. So, like I say, there are a couple of options there. But you may have here an example of something else we find in Scripture. Remember over there in Galatians chapter 6, Paul said, bear one another's burdens. And then two over there in the book of Romans chapter 12, he says, rejoice with them that
rejoice.
Well, rejoice with them that rejoice and weep with them that weep. So share the good times, share the bad. Since Peter and John had gone through some difficult times, maybe part of the going back to their own company was to do what we find in Galatians chapter 6 and Romans chapter 12. Certainly, they avoided a beating, but that's not going to be delayed too often or too long, because when you look at the next chapter, Acts 5 verse 18, and then Acts chapter 5 verses 40 and 41, the apostles are beaten at that time. Here we want to pay attention, we want to focus on the prayer, verse 24. And as you look at the prayer, how does it begin? Oh,
Lord.
Now normally when you find that word Lord in Scripture, it's kurios, K-U-R-I-O-S. That's the typical word for Lord. But the word which is translated Lord here is not that word. It's a word which is used about a dozen times. Every one of those times is in the book of Acts, except in Romans chapter 15. I think it's Romans chapter 15. Let me look at my notes again here. Don't see that right off. I was thinking it was Romans chapter 15. There. I think it was Romans chapter 15, verse 6, but I have to go back and look at that. I don't see that handy. But anyway, the word that is used here, it is a word which describes, I'll give you the quote, the highest magistrate or officer. It occurs, like I say, about a dozen times in Scripture, and when it's used, it describes praying to God in several of those cases. It would be like when you think of a master over a slave. That master is the Lord of the servant. When that master, if it's a true master-slave relationship, when the master tells a slave to, you know, go out and bring in the cows, you know, unless he wants to be beaten, unless he wants to be killed, what does he do? He goes and brings in the cows. So it's a word which describes pretty much absolute control. I find it interesting that they address Jesus in this way. Lord, to me, that would suggest absolute sovereign. He's the creator of heaven, earth, sea, everything that in them is. And, you know, they recognized his authority, and they're appealing to that authority as they engage in this prayer. A couple of the things, and then I want to turn our attention to a handout sheet. We've got about 20 minutes left, so hopefully we can make some progress with that. When you look at Peter and John, and they come back and they start making the report, we don't have a lot of details, but do you see any hint in there of malice, hate, anger? I mean, they've not been treated well by the Sanhedrin, have they? Being brought before all those people and put on the spot. Do you see any hint of anything sinful on their part? No, nothing is there. It reminds you a little bit of what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, verses 10 through 12. He said, with your enemies, do what with them? All right, love them, pray for them, bless the people who curse you. And that may have been not the first thought on their mind, but to me that seems like that's how they were trying to approach the situation. These Christians, Peter and John, they turned to God. They turned to God's power in this prayer. They turned to his word. They turned to prayer, and they turned to fellow saints. There, to me, seems to be a great lesson in that. Today, when people go through difficult times, and I'm thinking about Christians, they go through a hard time. You know, maybe it's a divorce. Maybe it's a job loss. Maybe it's bad health. Where do they turn oftentimes? Externally or internally? Yeah. And how do you see that? All right, they do. You know, people that they used to have contact with, they cut off those relationships. They used to come out to services, don't want to do that anymore. And what about with God? I used to pray. I used to read my Bible. I used to have a spiritual life. But because bad times have befallen me, God has let me down. Now, that may not be exactly what they think, but it would be along those lines. And what am I going to do? I'm going to choke off my spiritual life. I'm going to hide from that. That's not what these Christians did. Difficult times come up, and what do? They seek out fellow saints. They go to their companions, and they go to their God. And they're thinking about him. They're praying to him. They're calling to mind his word. And that is why I said in a couple of weeks we want to take a look at Psalm 2. So they find a lot of comfort in one another. Luke uses a word which is translated one accord, and that's used a number of times in the New Testament. Anything you want to add or ask over what we've talked about thus far? All right, well, here's where I want to make the transition. Again, looking at what you have there back in Acts chapter 4, verse 24, this is the basis for it. He said, "Thou didst make the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that in them is." This is something that we've not looked at or done as far as trying to... Jeremy, would you mind helping pass out a little bit? Maybe about a third of those. Thank you. Stand on last. Just give you the same if you wouldn't mind. We've talked about creation and evolution at various times, but I can't ever remember looking at creation as far as what the Bible specifically says about it and break that down by subject. I was kind of intrigued by some of the verses I came out with. As you look at the sheet, creation or evolution. Now, if you're dealing with someone who does not believe in God and creation, it's probably not best to open up the Bible and say, well, this is, you know, the truth about creation, because they're not going to accept that book. But if you are dealing with someone, or for yourself personally, if you're looking at creation, this is what the Bible says about it, and there's a lot there. As I said, we're not going to be able, with about 17 minutes, to get through all this, but let's at least kind of see the quick points. The points quickly. A quick overview. There's some specific things said about animals, birds and fish, earth, grass, herbs and trees, sun, moon and stars, seas, and humanity. And let's get some helpers lined up here. I'm going to skip the quick overview. I think we can have a general understanding of that based on the knowledge that we have, that God is the one who created all things. So since we can't get through all the verses, that's going to be less critical for the class. But let's Genesis 1, Genesis 2, we'll ask for a reader to get both of those passages, and then we'll head over to Jeremiah chapter 27, verse 5. Genesis 1, verse 24, that'll be Dolores. We'll also ask you to read Genesis 2, verse 19. Jeremiah chapter 27, verse 5, who will take that? All right, Jenny. All right, Dolores, let's go back to you. Genesis chapter 1, verse 24. Okay, let's fill in our blank. Reptiles, not every translation would use that word, but that's what's being described. Wildlife are also part of Genesis chapter 1, verse 24. But the easy one to fill in as far as a blank is what? God also created the... Well, I was thinking livestock. All right, livestock or beasts. So that's come from God. All right, if you will look at the next chapter, Dolores, Genesis chapter 2, verse 19. Okay, let's read about the first six words again. I want to make sure people got it.
So the Lord God formed from the ground.
There it is. God created them, but God created them from where? From the ground. Now think about that. The next time that you see a wildlife, the next time that you see reptiles, the next time that you see livestock, those creatures were formed from the ground by God. Genesis 2, verse 19. All right, Jenny, let's take a look at Jeremiah chapter 27, verse 5. Okay, a couple quick points here. Thinking about Genesis chapter 1, God says all these items that you see, all the animals, the creatures, the wildlife, the reptiles, made them from where? The ground. Now to do that, what's going to be required? Yeah, that's incredible power. You think about, how can that be done? Well, evolution didn't do it if the Bible is true. So that's a general summation of animals. Let's turn our attention to birds and fish. Genesis chapter 1, verse 22. Dolores, you're still back there in that section? All right, we'll have you read that. Genesis, and then we'll look at Genesis 1, 21 after we deal with Genesis 9, 2. Genesis 9, 2, who wants to take care of that one for us? Gary, Genesis 9, verse 2. Dolores, let's go back to you. Genesis chapter 1, verse 22. Okay, what was God's command to or for the birds?
Multiply.
Now think about that. creation. God just says to the birds, be created, multiply, fill the earth. What kind of power can do that? I mean, to me, that is just, that's beyond my ability to grasp. Where you just say, you know, appear. And that's how it was done with the birds. That's what we find affirmed when it comes to creation. All right, Genesis chapter 9, verse 2. Okay, and I highlight birds here, but we could also include some other creatures. Instinct is what we see in Genesis 9, verse 2. Not only do we see instinct here, we see a specific kind or type of instinct. What instinct did God put in the birds? Fear of man. Isn't that true? See the bird out there? It's the robin, it's the sparrow. You know, probably not going to find as many birds now this time of year as you will when things warm up a bit. But you know, you try to go up, just can't grab that bird by the hand. It's going to have fear. Where did that come from? God created them, birds appear, and then also put the fear of man into them. And that fear of man continues, doesn't it? They've not outgrown it. Time has not caused it to cease. So once again, truly amazing. Christians, as you look at Acts 4, verse 24, they were amazed by the creation. They honor God because of the creation. When you start going back and you look at the creation, you have to say we can understand why they did that. Genesis 1, verse 21. Let's go back there, Dolores, to you. When it comes to the sea, what did God create there? Everything. People talk about, you know, sea monsters sometimes. Well, whatever monsters may have been out there in the deep, they came from God. We see, maybe we go to SeaWorld, or maybe we're out in a ship and we have a boat tour and we see the whales, we see the porpoises, maybe we have the chance to see various sharks and we're impressed. Maybe a large stingray. But once again, you know, as kids see that and say, hey, that's neat. Wow, look at that. What should our response be? It was created and created by God. That's a point that we always want to make sure that we make with our young people. All right, let's think about turning away from birds, fish, and animals for a second. Let's think about the earth. Genesis 9, verse 6. Are we still close to Genesis 9? All right. Let's see. I'm sorry, Nehemiah. I've got a contact that's off this morning. Steve, if you'll take that. All right, when it comes to the earth, how did it get here?
God made it.
So he made the earth. From the earth, he made the animals. And then as we think about the earth, he not only made the earth, but that passage also says he does what with it? He... Wasn't the word preserve in there, Steve? Okay, God made the earth. God preserves the earth. So he's not only a creator, he's also a sustainer. Let's get some help from the book of Psalms. Two passages, Psalm 90, verse 2, Psalm 115, verse 15, and then we'll look at Isaiah chapter 48 or 45, verse 18. Psalm 90, verse 2, that'll be Dolores. Psalm 115, verse 15. All right, Gary. And then let's also head down to Isaiah 45, verse 18. All right, Carol. Psalm 90, verse 2. Okay, what do we learn from that passage? We think about creation, how magnificent it was, but even before creation, what was true about the Creator?
He was eternal.
All right, he's eternal. So the idea that God could bring in to being the earth and the various things that we've talked about, no problem for him. All right, Psalm 115, verse 15. Is that 115:15?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I need to correct that reference. I apologize for that. All right, let's take a look at Isaiah 45, verse 15.
18.
Or 18. Like I said, my vision's off this morning, so thanks for helping me.
For thus says the Lord who created the heavens, he is the God who formed the earth and made it. He established it and did not not created a waste place, but formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else.
Okay, this one might be a little trickier, but would you like to take a stab at what should go in the blank? The earth was
formed.
What does that word imply? Think carefully about that. The earth was formed.
At one point, it didn't have form.
All right. I think that you could make that deduction. There was a time where it wasn't. It was that void state that we read about in the book of Genesis. What else?
It was put together.
Yeah. When you think about it, if you're working with pottery, for example, and you form a pot, or you form cookies that you're going to bake, or you are working with concrete, you know, and you have a form out there that you put in a particular shape, so it's going to come out in a particular design. That implies that, once again, God was not only the creator, but he used a great deal of care. It was a very specific process that was used. All right, Jeremiah 10:12, Revelation chapter 14, 6, and 7. Let's look at those two verses as well.
Brad.
I'm sorry? There again. Yeah. Yeah. So he's not only the former, but he's also the producer of the material. So he provides the raw material and then brings it to the state. So when you start thinking about God, the creation, very easy to say, well, God created the heavens, the earth, the animals, and so forth. Yes, but there are a few more details that we can add to it.
Psalm 115 references the next verse, the 16th.
Was it? Okay.
It says, "The heaven, even the heavens, are the Lord's, but the earth hath he given to the children of men."
Okay, thank you. The earth has been, let's fill in our blanks then. The earth has been given to the children of men. That's interesting. I've been flipping back and forth between glasses and contacts. They've been going back and forth for about 6 weeks trying to get me some right contacts. So it's been a little bit of a challenge to see some days. So when you think about the earth, it's ours. We have been made stewards of it. And that's clearly brought out in the book of Genesis. So thank you very much, Gary. Okay, let's take a look at Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 12. Anybody want to read that for us? Are you ready? All right, Carol.
It is he who made the earth by his power, who established the world by his wisdom, and by his understanding he has stretched out the heavens.
Okay, can we fill in the blanks? God used wisdom and understanding in creation. What does that suggest to you? Yeah, it takes you back to that idea that the earth was formed. Now, you might form something, you do a bad job. You know, just quickly form it up and, well, it doesn't turn out very well. But you can also form something where after it's formed, after it's put together, you say, wow, he was pretty smart. That person took a lot of time. A lot of attention to detail was given. And when you start looking at how the earth is put together, that's exactly what you find. Okay, let's take a look at Revelation chapter 14, verses 6 and 7. Now, this is a verse which you may not have looked at in this way before, but I think it's instructive. Revelation 14, 6 and 7. Somebody want to head back there and be ready for that reading? All right, Dolores.
And I saw another angel flying through the sky, carrying the eternal good news to proclaim to the people who belong to this world, to every nation, tribe, and language, and people.
Was that 14, 6, and 7?
Oh, and 7. Fear God, he shouted. Give glory to him, for the time has come when he will sit as judge. Worship him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all springs of water.
All right, thank you very much. We've got the angel in 14, 6. And then in 14, 7, what's the angel say? God created. So, as you look at the question here, do angels believe in evolution? That one sure didn't. That angel believed in creation. Now, if anybody should know whether or not creation is true, wouldn't it be an angel? I would think that they'd be a pretty good source. God's word, of course, also tells us in a lot of other ways that God has created. He used that wisdom. He used that magnificent understanding. He used a great deal of care and so forth. But I also find it's interesting that angels were involved with creation. All right, let's turn our attention to grass, herbs, and trees. Genesis 1, verse 11, and then we'll look at that passage again, but add verse 12 to it as well. Genesis 1, chapter 111. Let's see where grass came from. Who's got it? All right, Betty?
God said, let the earth put forth grass, herbs, yielding
seed and fruit trees bearing fruit after their kind.
Okay, grass. We see it. Sometimes it's covered up a bit this time of year. Where did the grass come from? Came from God. So the next time you're out there mowing grass, next time you're out there planting grass seed, think about where it came from. Grass has come from God. It's not a byproduct of evolution or anything like that. All right, with that in mind, let's also have you read verse 12, if you would, Betty.
And the earth brought forth grass, herb yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit. For in is the seed thereof after their kind, and God saw that it was good.
All right, now I'm not sure Genesis 1:12 is a passage that may be on your minds very often, but I think it's an important passage. When you open up that piece of fruit, and it's got that seed inside, what might be your first thought? I'll tell you what my first thought generally is. And it's probably not a real good thought.
It's wasted space.
Well, yeah, you could say it's wasted space. It's kind of a pain, isn't it? You know, maybe you got to dig it out, or maybe if it's like an apple, you got various seeds in there. I think to myself, I sure wish this didn't have a seed. But every time you open up that piece of fruit and it's got a seed inside, what should that remind you of? Genesis 1 verse 12. This has come from God. This is from the Creator. Every piece of fruit which has a seed should remind us of that. So the next time you crack open a piece of fruit and you're struggling with the seed, or maybe you think, go back to Genesis 1:12. Anything you want to add or ask before we switch our attention to sun, moon, stars, and seas?
That's part of the sustaining part of
it. Exactly. It is. And that's where we get back to one of the passages that we looked at earlier. God's not only the creator, but he is a sustainer. I think that was our Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 6 reference. All right, let's go back to Genesis. You've been good about reading those, Dolores. You want to go back to Genesis 1? We're going to take Genesis 1:14 and divide it into A and B. First part and second part.
Then God said, let lights appear in the sky to separate the day from the night.
Okay, let's stop right there for a second. God made multiple lights. He's the creator. And why did he create multiple lights? Separate day and night. He thought that we would be profited by that. He knew that, and that's exactly right. All right, let's read the rest of it.
Let them be signs to mark the seasons, days, and years.
Okay, so not only do we have the ability with the lights to separate day and night, but also God made the various lights to do what?
Seasons.
All right, days and seasons. It helps us keep things on track. It helps us organize life a little bit better. All right, then let's take a look for a third purpose for the lights, Genesis 1, verse 15.
Let these lights in the sky shine down on the earth, and that is what happened.
Okay, light to shine where? On the earth. We benefit from that, don't we? Flashlight technology, if you look at it, people will pay big bucks for flashlights. Dan and I were talking about that not too long ago. People will shell out $100 for a flashlight. Now, you can buy, I'm not saying everybody will, but I'm saying that there are some people who will willingly shell that out for a flashlight. You know, you can get the $2.99 special at Walmart, but there are some people, if they want a really bright flashlight, they will buy some of the flashlights that you can see maybe a quarter mile, half a mile out. I mean, there are some fantastic flashlights right now, but God thought that he knew that we needed light and gave us that. All right, Genesis 1, verse 16, that next verse too, Dolores. God designed the moon for what? To, all right, help us at night. And we like that. We don't want a lot of light out there if we're probably trying to go to sleep, but a little light, moonlight, that can be nice for a lot of things. All right, Psalm 8, verse 3, Psalm 33, 6, Jeremiah 31, 35. I don't know if we can get all those in, but let's try. Psalm 8, 3, who wants to head back there and take care of it for us? All right, Gary, Psalm 8, 3, Psalm 33, 6, who will knock that one off? Jenny? And then our last one, Jeremiah 31, verse 35. Jeremiah 31, 35. Carol, thank you. All right, let's take a look at Psalm 8, verse 3.
When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained.
Once more, I'm not hearing what I wanted from that.
When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers.
There it is. The work of thy fingers. Now, isn't that interesting? Does God literally have fingers? No. But if you think about the moon, putting it together with fingers, oh, come on. What's the point there? Well, I think those items are good as far as suggestions, but what else? You're making something as large as a moon with your fingers.
Power.
You know, with the fingers, you know, it's not like he needs his whole body. Just the finger will make a moon out there. So once again, when we think about God, the magnificence of who he is, his creation, that's fantastic. Psalm 33, 6.
By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth.
Now, the heavens. I use the word galaxies here because that's what's being described. Galaxies were made by the breath of God's mouth. Now think about that. And I've just made who knows how many galleries or galaxies. Can you imagine the power that's involved with that? That's the point as far as the creator we serve. And then Jeremiah 31:35.
Thus says the Lord, who gives the sun for light by day, and the fixed order of the moon and the stars for light by night? Who stirs up the sea so that its waves roar? The Lord of hosts is his name.
Now can you imagine that? What do we stir sometimes? Yeah, we stir a bowl of soup, or maybe we stir a tea bag around a little bit. God stirs the sea. Are you kidding me? You're going to stir the sea? So there are some magnificent verses in the Bible about creation, so it's not surprising that as the first Christians prayed to God, they were mindful of just how powerful he is and how the creation demonstrates that.